My name is Mark Quarterman, and I'm the director of the program on crisis, conflict, and cooperation here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and very pleased on behalf of our program, on behalf of the center, to once again host the launch of the Global Peace Index, this time for 2011. At a time when we, so many of us, seem to be spending our time talking about conflict and crisis, it's actually refreshing to take a look at the other side and try to understand the building blocks of peace. The Program on Crisis, Conflict, and Cooperation, or C3, addresses dynamics in conflict and crisis-affected areas and tries to develop strategies to speed, enhance, and strengthen international crisis response and conflict management. And so a tool like the Global Peace Index helps us analyze crisis and conflict areas in their contexts, as well as identify those factors that are most vulnerable to conflict, but also susceptible to peace. It helps us to narrow where the focus needs to be. The GPI doesn't necessarily explain absolutely how or why, but it does point in directions for further important review. And as such, it's an increasingly indispensable resource and source of information and analysis. A central focus on our work is on governance in fragile states, and it was not a surprise but very nice to see that a core factor in the GPI's reckoning of peacefulness is effectiveness of governance. It's also useful to understand how current conflicts within particular countries relate to the rankings and ratings within the GPI. I'm especially impressed by the flexibility of the GPI team when, as they were coming to the end of the year and looking at their data and early in this year, realized that they needed to extend the time for the collection of data, given the Arab Spring, the events in the Arab Spring, and took the time to compile that information. The report would have been very useful if they hadn't done that, but it's that much more comprehensive and that much more timely because they did, and I applaud them for that. The GPI also reflects, I believe, the complexity of conflict. It's not isolated to one part of a given country or to one aspect. Often there are many layers to conflicts, and a fluidity of actors and transnational implications, and the GPI understands that very well. By focusing on indicators both of internal and external peace, the GPI gives a broad picture of the interlinked factors that are involved in peacefulness. So what do people do with this information? What do we do? Well, for those of us who work on issues of armed conflict and development, the GPI deepens our understanding of how and why violence can damage countries in two important ways. First, it provides us with a way of measuring many of the issues for which we had previously only had qualitative assessments. Such quantitative analysis is a powerful tool and has a powerful way of puncturing long-held but often unexamined beliefs. Second, the multi-year nature of the index gives us a means to understand the ways in which internal and external developments can affect a country's peacefulness over time. I look forward to the GPI's assessment over an even longer period of time, looking back over the data to look at the trajectory of countries over periods of time. There are, of course, few surprises at the top and bottom of the rankings, but rankings, while a useful way of drawing attention to the GPI, and especially useful when comparing similarly situated countries, only tell a limited part of the story. For me, the most significant lessons are from the application of the index to individual countries and what it says about those countries, because each summing up of a country tells a story about how people's lives are improved or worsened, and how effective their governments were in promoting peacefulness and how in taking advantage of the benefits of peacefulness. One feature I especially value is the unsentimental nature of the GPI. It applies a rigorous methodology that at times shows benefits, at least in the short term, for political stability from authoritarian actions, but demonstrates that in the short run that elections can be very destabilizing. But at the same time, a close look at the index shows that it includes a number of factors that demonstrate an understanding that respect for human rights, political participation, democracy have powerful correlations with peace. Finally, the GPI doesn't tell us, needless to say, everything we need to know. It's a snapshot, and that's important. But through this snapshot, we might discern how situations might shape up in the future. Egypt's present instability, for example, and its resulting fall in the rankings could end up being an investment in a more democratic, open, and effectively governed Egypt. This we can only hope for. But the GPI tells us how the situation looks now, and that is a very important contribution. I'm pleased today to have three panelists who are distinguished panelists to talk about the GPI, two who participated in it and one who is a seasoned observer of international issues, especially, as we were discussing earlier, in many of the countries near the bottom of the ranking, to comment on it. First, and to my left, we have Clyde McConaghy, who serves as a board member of the Institute for Economics and Peace, which produces the Global Peace Index. He's group managing director of a group of public and private companies in the technology, filmmaking, venture capital, and charity sectors. He has presented at the United Nations in New York and worked on an advisory board with the OECD. He has a number of decades of experience in global business management, and is developing quite a bit of experience on the public side as well through his very good work with the GPI. To his left is Leo Abruzzi, who is the North American Editorial Director and Financial Services Director for the Economist Intelligence Unit, which played a major role in putting together the GPI. He's based in New York and oversees a team of country analysts and is responsible for the Economist Intelligence Unit's business research projects in the region. He writes regularly on the U.S. economy and leads the Economist Intelligence Unit's financial services coverage, which provides analysis of conditions in 60 markets. And finally, we have a distinguished journalist, Barbara Slavin, who's an expert on U.S. foreign policy and the author of a 2007 book on Iran entitled Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council specializing on Iran, and she's also a contributor to AOLnews.com and foreignpolicy.com, among other media outlets, and as we discussed, has been a close observer for many years of a number of the countries, especially near the bottom of the rankings, and I look forward to hearing what she has to say about the latest edition of the GPI and her views in general on questions of peace and peacefulness. But I'll start with Clyde McConaghy. Thanks, Clyde.
Voila. It is now. Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you all very much for making the time to come along this morning. It was interesting that you said increasingly indispensable tool. They're three quite interesting words, not ones that I would necessarily use myself about our work, because it would seem very immodest to do so, but they are important in the sense that it is increasing, in the sense that it's hard to think that it was only 4 years ago when I was here standing up doing the first Global Peace Index, and we didn't even know if there was going to be a second, let alone a fifth. And there's more likely to be a 15th now, I think it's probably pretty safe to say, because we have so many requests for people to say, look at historical data. Well, in 15 years' time, we'll be able to call the work that we're doing now somewhat historical. Indispensable is a very important word as well, because I think the indispensability is actually not the GPI itself, it's the fact that we're talking about peace. That's the indispensable part. That's the one that we created the GPI for and wish it to become a greater focus for international media, academics, philanthropists, and various others. So that's the indispensability about it. And the tool is quite important as well, because really this was created as a tool for others to do their work better or make better decisions, whether that's for a board director of an organization, a company that's trying to work out where to make their next $150 million investment of a factory, or whether it be a philanthropist who's thinking where they will put their next $100,000 or $100 million in terms of research, or whether that be an NGO trying to think where they can best utilize their resources, or it might be an academic or indeed a politician seeking to make better policy decisions that would lead to a more peaceful nation for them. So thank you very much for that introduction, and I think you've pretty much summarised it all, so I'll just give you a little bit more detail about what the results were. Now, I've got a few slides here, but I think in some ways this is an important one, and I don't expect you to be able to read the very small type. It's become very small type because this is just a list of some of our supporters who really signed on, shall we say, at the very beginning, 3, 4, 5 years ago, to say, we think what you're doing is important. And it's important because it will hopefully lead to a better state of the world and a more prolific and dynamic state of peace on Earth. So this is just some of the people that have helped us. Now, the agenda for my presentation, I actually have a few slides this year, a little bit more than usual, but I will endeavour to go through them fairly quickly. So I'll be talking about the GPI results, but I only have 4, or indeed 5 slides on that. Leo, I'm going to leave to talk about the methodology and some of the nuances of the results in a lot more detail, so we won't be doubling up. I've got 5 slides on the monetary value of peace, which, for those of you that were here last year, will know that we actually introduced the economic value, the opportunity cost of peace on Earth on a country-by-country basis. I'm going to update those figures. I've got 9 slides, which I will actually go through fairly quickly, on the US Peace Index. Now, some or all of you might be aware that last month, Steve Killelay, my chairman and the chairman of the IEP, presented the US Peace Index to the states, and it was the first ever measure of a nation, state by state, its peacefulness within those states. I've got 9 slides, but I'll go through them fairly quickly, but it is relevant because it is an indication of what the IEP is going to be doing in the future. So you won't be the only ones to be covered. And lastly, which is actually where I want to focus, is what we call peace and human potential, which is about peace and social sustainability. So I'll kick off. It's interesting to see, just before I tell you who topped the list this year, and indeed who came at the bottom, to see that this summarises the number of countries that we look at, the year, of course, of publication, and the average GPI score, bearing in mind it's a score out of 5. So in 2007, when we introduced it, the average score of a country was 1.94. In 2011, it's 2.05. Which in and of itself is not a good thing, of course, because that means the world is becoming less peaceful, despite having a blip and becoming more peaceful in 2008. But it also shows that the number of countries on that fourth column from the left is becoming a larger number of countries that are actually becoming less peaceful. Unfortunately, that highlighted in last year when 106 countries from the previous year became less peaceful, and that came on the back of the global financial crisis. Nonetheless, this year, Iceland, on the back of the global financial crisis, reclaims, shall we say, number one spot, which it lost 3 years ago as a result of that crisis, and they're manifesting itself in violence on the streets in Iceland, and it fell 4 positions, which on the GPI, particularly at the top, is actually quite a big fall because the numbers are very, very tight towards the top. Nonetheless, Iceland regains top position, shall we say. Interestingly enough, we see Czech come into the top 10, which is the Czech Republic. First time it's come really into the top 10% of the GPI, and quite an admirable achievement. There's certainly things that can still be done there, but nonetheless it's a very big increase compared to what it would have been in previous years. Slovenia as well, another, shall we say, new entrant. So for those of you that have seen this 4 or 5 times, you'll start to see that that top 10 countries is actually becoming quite a geographically diverse mix. It's not just, frankly, Western European nations, or indeed, I mean, Japan's obviously there, Canada's up there. Canada, actually, it's the first time it's been in the top 10 as well. So it's becoming quite a diverse group, and indeed, geographically, from Iceland to New Zealand to Japan, is all really on the, if there are 4 corners of the globe, that's well represented. Nonetheless, at the bottom of the index, Somalia has ranked 153rd this year. It's the first time that Iraq hasn't been on the bottom of the Global Peace Index, actually. And to its credit, shall we say, even though it's a one-rank move, it's actually nonetheless an important one because it had improvements on quite a number of the indicators. At the bottom of the index, it's very difficult to, in fact, move many places because the gaps are quite large. But nonetheless, for Iraq, it was an improvement. It didn't just get there because Somalia became worse. In fact, Somalia's score improved, but Iraq's improved disproportionately more. So the other countries, it's the first time that the Central African Republic has been in the top 10 as well. And for the rest of the countries, DRC is a Democratic Republic of Congo. Some of those countries have been there for some years running. But nonetheless, there have been improvements, even though the average score of them has generally gone down. So I will leave Leo to discuss some of those countries in more detail. What I always like, and this is probably my favourite slide out of the whole presentation each year, is in fact the risers and fallers, because this is the movers and the shakers, the improvers and those who have fallen. And why is that? That's because it doesn't really matter whether you're at the top of the index if you've made the most gains. And indeed, if you look at some of the top five risers, thinking of Sri Lanka, Thailand and Georgia, all of those 2 years ago were in very different places than they are now. And if you look at the ranking changes, 20 and 30 positions, that's no mean feat, considering that the GPI is measured in thousandths. You know, a score of 2.407 is there's 2,407 different positions that you could have to get that score. So, as I say, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Georgia are countries that have improved dramatically and show the resilience of a country in terms of reversing its position from a place of violence. Alternatively, and this is what Mark was referring to, Libya, Bahrain, Egypt are examples of countries that have fallen considerable amounts. Now, I will leave Leo again to speak about the methodology and the IEP's rationale for revising the time period. Suffice to say that it was those indicators that were able to be brought a little bit more into topicality in about February and March that actually reflected those falls. And I might point out that Libya's fall of 83 places is the biggest fall ever recorded in the GPI history of 5 years. Indeed, Bahrain's would be pretty close as well. Madagascar is worth pointing out because, generally speaking, small island states do well on the GPI. It is an anomaly not only in being the top five faller, but also an anomaly in the sense that it is even there, because generally, I suppose Sri Lanka is an example of a country that's come back from a great level of difficulty. So they're the top five risers and fallers. The US, 82nd position. So that's a three-position improvement in its rank. Its score did not change this year. It was 2.06, and the global average for this year is 2.05, so it's middle ranking, I suppose, in terms of score. And the major indicator movements were as an improvement, that is a lessening of, levels of violent crime, but that was contrasted with increasing number of deaths from external conflict, which really balanced that out. Interestingly enough, and it was only in a discussion on Monday that this occurred to me, that the US has actually improved, relatively speaking, quite considerably. It was in 96th position out of 120 countries when I first presented this 4 years ago. Now it's 82nd position in 153 countries. So it's gone from the bottom quartile in the first year, or the top of the bottom quartile, to well into, let's say, halfway. So in relative terms, I can't think of another, let's say, OECD country that has had that level of change either way, let alone improvement. So the monetary value of peace, about five slides. That is just simply gives you a very quick indication of some of the things that we were trying to find out in order to determine the economic value of peace. Suffice to say, we didn't find much. And perhaps that gets back to the point of the GPI being an analytical, rigorous statistical base, that there wasn't something like that could be overlapped with typically analytical, rigorous economic information. So what we did do was, a couple of years ago, we had Professor John Tepper-Marlin, Professor Jürgen Brauer develop for us, it was actually in the 2008 year, for 2007 numbers, the economic cost of peace in the world on an annual basis. And they came up with this estimate that it was about $7.3 trillion per annum, made up of that's the 2.46, $2.46 trillion worth of economic activity that could be diverted from violence-related issues, and another $4.8 trillion of foregone economic activity. So having the Economist Intelligence Unit involved has been helpful. They didn't do these numbers, but it's given us an opportunity to leverage GPI in ways that enable business, indeed, to start to understand the cost implications and foregone revenue implications of peace or a lack of peace. But more importantly, we estimate that it's about $38 trillion in the last 5 years on the global economy that's been foregone as a cost of violence. Now, if we were to take that figure and say that if the figure for 2010 being $8 trillion and say, well, it might be a little bit hypothetical to say there's no more violence, but to say there's 25% less, a quarter less, is actually a number that we can work with. And indeed, $2 trillion per annum would do the following: pay the Millennium Development Goals, which is about $60 billion per annum, pay for the EU climate change targets, another 48 billion euro. The Japanese tsunami and earthquake is about 235 billion, and repay Greece, Portugal, and Ireland's debt. Not necessarily saying this is a policy recommendation, I'm just saying what you could do with the money. 700 billion, and you've still got $1 trillion left to do other things. So this is real money, as we say in business. This could make a considerable difference. And certainly, if you look at what the discussion that's going on in the US at the moment with the media about allocation of funds and availability of resources, they're very relevant numbers. So military expenditure, if we actually focus on that, because that's one of the indicators that improved. It is the single biggest improvement in the GPI indicators was military expenditure as a proportion of GDP. And there, for example, it was 2.7%, I should say, and is now 2.6%, which in these numbers makes a big difference. There's a few countries and their GDP proportion spent on the military. Now, if we then think, overlay that with the results of the GPI, relations with neighbouring states has actually improved in 3 of the last 4 years. Conventional military spending in the West far exceeds other blocs. The 10-year war on terror, and yet the indicator for the potential for terrorist acts has worsened, has actually increased over that same period. That was one of the indicators this year that has particularly worsened the most, the potential for terrorist acts. And indeed, peace has declined globally in the last 5 years. So overlaying GPI with economic and military spending tends to suggest that there's a new paradigm required for peace. So what could that paradigm be? Now, these slides, as I say, I won't go into in enormous detail because they have been covered and the reports are available from Michelle at the back should you wish to see it. But it is the first of many. We did the US because it has excellent data. We could do a historical analysis. It's a large, wealthy nation. It's got high levels of military spending. And it's very likely that in the next 12 months there'll be one or two or three other countries that pop up that we do. Nonetheless, very quickly, the five indicators, they're the five indicators from the GPI, and we kept the weightings exactly the same. In other words, we kept methodologically sound. I won't go over those because they're all in the documentation. And that was the snapshot view of the US in terms of peacefulness on a state-by-state basis. That's in your documents. There's the list of 1 to 50. So there might be a few surprises, but also there's probably a fair few that you'd think that seems about right. The most improved, I'll get to in a minute, but the key findings are that since the mid-1990s, the US has become more peaceful, about an 8% improvement, that peace is strongly correlated with educational, particularly high school education levels, economic opportunity, and indeed health. That the increase in peace has been driven by a reduction in violent crime and homicide, because bear in mind that, of course, a national peace index takes no account of military, because that's mainly an external factor. Incarceration rate has substantially increased over the moving period, which has actually brought a lot of the states down, and that the most states have improved in peace, and those that have improved the most New York and California, I mean the area around New York and California, particularly California, has improved by far the most. Now, that list is purely a series of socioeconomic and demographic factors, all of which had very, very strong correlations with the work that we did on the United States Peace Index. I won't go into them, obviously, on a one-by-one basis. Suffice to say, it was a very compelling argument. And the next three slides give you some quick examples of the numbers. We then said, okay, if the US was as peaceful as Canada, or indeed some other countries, what economic benefit would there be? So if we took Canada's peace in GPI ranking and US peace index GPI ranking, and then overlaid that with the value, the economic value, what would we find? So if the US was as peaceful as Canada, which on homicides, I beg your pardon, violent crimes, is Canada's at 300 per 100,000 population on the left, and the US is at about 425, the US would benefit about $27 billion per annum, right down to, say, Switzerland. If it had the same violent crime rate, about half, as Switzerland, it'd be a $53 billion annual improvement. If I take that in terms of homicide rate, so 5 out of 100,000 for the US, and match that against, say, Canada, which is in the top 10, it's about 1.6, 1.7 per 100,000, we're talking $16 billion per annum. And finally, if you take incarceration rates, where the US, as you're probably aware, has not only the highest per capita, but the highest in absolute numbers of people in jail, and if that were matched with Canada, it would be $65 billion per annum economic benefit, $63 billion if compared with the UK, and all the way up to $72 billion per annum if matched with Denmark. So, for the economists or analysts amongst you, there is a dollar-by-dollar summary of $361 billion that would be of economic benefit if the US were having a violence level as low as Canada, made up of medical costs, total incarceration rates, police services, judicial, and then in the second box, the white box, slightly lower, productivity loss from homicides, rape and assault, and adding prisoners back into the workforce. So in absolute dollar terms, it's $90 billion in terms of costs, and there's another $135 billion of economic activity that hasn't happened. And then we have taken the economically credible, but nonetheless speculative estimation of a multiplier effect, which applies in economics, and added another $135 billion, because a multiplier of one is reasonable, and that's $361 billion per annum. The final section, and then I'll introduce Leo, is the following 9 or 10 slides, and a couple of them are just graphs, so I'll go over them quickly. We've been asked many years now, how can we relate the GPI to public issues of social sustainability, environmental sustainability, and various other things? So I think with 3 or 4 years of data, we can actually finally do that, and that's what this section is about. So we wanted to overlay and find sources of strong social information, societal information that we could use. So what we did is we went to firstly identify through our own research 8 structures of peace. So sound business environment, well-functioning government, equitable distribution of resources, free flow of information, low levels of corruption, the acceptance of the rights of others, high levels of education, and good relationships with neighbours, neighbouring countries, that is. So with those 8 structures that we determined from our own work in the IEP, we overlaid that with, firstly, we had a look at the media and the coverage of violence around the world. And that snapshot there is the coverage of violence topics in thousands. So I'll just take a minute to explain this one. It goes from the center. You can see 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, and 100,000. That is number of articles on violence in about 36 media outlets, TV, throughout the world. And on the left, part of that spider diagram, is what the topics were: defence, defence military, domestic security, crime. And you can see most of them are in the, it's a logarithmic scale, in the tens and hundreds of thousands. On the right are the topics of conversation in the media worldwide on what we call the structures of peace, the things that will actually lead to a more peaceful either resolution or post conflict reconstruction, education, functioning of government, business environment. So we've actually literally went away with Media Tenor, another organisation, and analysed every TV article story and came up with that. Then we looked at Afghanistan. So if I flick between the two, you can see that in fact the topics that are covered on the structures that will create a more peaceful Afghanistan, even if you're finding it difficult to read, it's a very different shape. Enormous coverage. In fact, it literally goes off the scale with the networks that we looked at in terms of the coverage of topics of war and violence. And on only two, the functioning of government and relationships with neighbours, were there more than sufficient coverage. On every other one that will actually lead to a more peaceful Afghanistan, there was woefully insufficient. So that's about halfway through this section. The structures of peace, and this is a definition that was given to us, social sustainability is determined by the strength of the social institutions that enable greater well-being and resilience. So resilience being recovering, like Japan from the earthquake and the tsunami, Iceland recovering from the global financial crisis, and we saw they re-achieved their sort of number one position. But if we then look at social sustainability, which is defined as we understand by the International Institute of Social Studies as including civil activism, intergroup cohesion, interpersonal safety and trust, gender equality, and one other clubs and associations, they are very strongly correlated with the GPI. And I'll just leaf over these next few slides, but suffice to say, all of these numbers are expressed between 0 and 1, or in fact, indeed, 0 and minus 1. They are correlations, and it's broadly believed or felt that a correlation between factors of 0.5 and higher means a highly correlated, a great level of relationship between it. So we compared the GPI with the Club de Madrid Shared Societies Index with gender equality, civic activism, and various other, and found very strong results other than on this factor at the bottom called clubs and associations. Nonetheless, there were very, very strong relationships and certainly intergroup cohesion. So then if we looked at the structures of peace that I just spoke about, well-functioning government, that list there is a list of indexes and measures of other organisations, the Freedom House Political Rights Index, Political Democracy Index, and various others, all with very, very strong associations. So basically we realise that the structures of peace and peace and sustainability, social sustainability, are intrinsically linked. The acceptance of the rights of others, we looked at civil liberties, we looked at the Legatum Institute's Personal Freedom Index, political participation, all very strongly correlated. Good relationships with neighbours, the same. And then the last three slides are simply graphic representations that societies with lower discrimination, where their citizens accept the rights of others, tend to be more peaceful. So on that scale, the GPI is the bottom axis, so 1 and 1.5 meaning a very low, very good GPI score. And on the left-hand axis, the vertical axis, the higher the better. So those countries that tend to be more peaceful tend to be those with low levels of discrimination. We have nations better performed where their citizens are more peaceful, so that's a civil activism. Activism, by the way, is not necessarily meaning placard waving, demonstrating down the streets. It's actually engagement in the civil institutions of the society. High levels of trust, so that was interpersonal safety and trust as measured by the International Institute for Social Studies. And indeed, gender equality, where those countries in the top left-hand corner tend to have higher rankings. So last slide, and in fact Mark commented on it in his introduction, how is this used, who is it used by? That is just a real snapshot of a selection of organisations, CIPRI, which some of you will know, Cranfield University in the UK, the Aspen Institute, with whom we have a very strong association to roll out aspects of the GPI to MBA programmes throughout the world. The World Bank and OECD have engaged at UNDP. We have the IEP has just funded the world's first chair in peace and economics. So I think I stood here last year and said there wasn't a single university in the world that funds a chair, a professorship in peace economics. So we have just written out a six-figure check to fund that. So that's we're now recruiting. So if anybody's interested in applying, you can go to our website and see the if you've got a professorship, then Monash University in Melbourne, good weather. And I think measured by the EIU as one of the most livable cities in the world. So there's my plug for the EIU. So Club de Madrid, Global Symposium in Peaceful Nations, in fact organised by Chick Dambach. So that's just some of its partners and uses. Thank you very much.
Clyde, thank you very much. Leo.
Thank you. Just going to take a moment to cue this up, if I can find it. Oh, we had it. We lost it. There we are. Right. Thank you very much, Clyde and Mark. Again, just to mention again, my name is Leo Abruzzi. I work with the Economist Intelligence Unit. We are a sister organization of The Economist magazine, so I'm sure most of you are familiar with The Economist. Our role is a bit different. The Economist, of course, is a very, very good public affairs magazine. The Economist Intelligence Unit has country specialists. Our particular role is to analyze countries in great detail, both economically and politically. We were commissioned by Clyde and by the Institute for Economics and Peace to assemble the Global Peace Index. This is no mean task. As I'm sure you've probably seen from looking at the countries, this is controversial. Some countries at the top, of course, are very happy. Whenever we build indices, we always remind our clients that there will be countries at the bottom and they will be very unhappy. And there are countries at the bottom and they are very unhappy. What I would like to take you through very briefly, and then I'd like to turn it over to Barbara so we can begin a Q&A discussion, is to speak a bit about the methodology that we use to produce this, because it does matter. Especially it matters in a city like Washington, where almost everyone has a particular political axe to grind one way or the other. So our goal in putting this together, we had three objectives. One, this was going to be unbiased. It was impartial. No political agenda. This does not come from the right or the left. And most importantly, we wanted to make it methodologically rigorous. So we put together a panel of experts. We tried to measure relative states of peace, and we went where the numbers took us. There are no thumbs on the scale here, and we'll take you a bit through the process on how we reached the conclusions that we did. We looked at 153 countries, as Clyde mentioned, across 23 different indicators. Again, the way indices often work is you choose a group of high-level categories and then a number of indicators which support those. So we looked here at both internal peace, that is to say, what is the society like within a country? Is there a civil war within the country? Are there social protests on the streets every day? Internal peace. And then external peace, which is fairly obvious. Are you involved, by and large, in wars with your neighbors? So we looked at 23 different indicators measuring all aspects of peace within a society, external peace as well. We also looked at some interesting things, the number of people, for example, who are in prison in each country, on the assumption that if large portions of your population are in jail, and large portions of the U.S. population are in jail, that that is not conducive to a peaceful environment. At the end of this process, we took the scores, and Clyde has shown you some of the scores, and we tried to correlate those against what we would call drivers or determinants of peace. So fine, we know that Iceland and Norway and Denmark and Japan and Canada all finish in the top 10. But what is there about those countries? Do they have something in common that causes them to come near the top? So once we completed the actual calculation on who was in the index and where, we then tried to look at some of the characteristics or the determinants. We have broadened this index over the years. We started with about 120 countries. I remember the first year we did not do Afghanistan. We got a few requests on why not. There was no data, but happily Afghanistan's data reporting has gotten a little bit better, so we felt that we could add some countries over the years. We have 153. Hopefully, if a country that you care about is not on this list, most likely, assuming there is some information that we can analyze, we hope to put it on in future years. But as you can see, regionally, every region is very well represented. Now, how we assembled this, it's important to understand that we used both quantitative, that is, hard number-based indicators, and others that were qualitative. So, for example, I mentioned earlier about the number of people in a country who are jailed. or the number of homicides in a country. Those are hard quantitative aspects that you can gather. There are organizations, UN, police chief associations, others who count these figures. So the majority of the indicators are quantitative numbers that we took from internationally reliable sources. As good as that is, we've always felt when we built indices that there are qualitative measures that you have to include. So, for example, we have a political stability measure here. There's no number specifically you're going to attach to political stability unless you create an indicator for it, and we've done that. Because at the Economist Intelligence Unit, we have about 120 full-time analysts who do nothing but cover countries. So we have a U.S. analyst, not surprisingly, but we have a Nepal analyst, we have a Mali analyst, we have a Paraguay analyst. So we're in a good position that when we are trying to make a qualitative judgment, how politically stable is a Nepal or a Paraguay or a Colombia, we have members of our team who pretty much do nothing but track those countries. So while the qualitative measures are subjective, you could say it's the opinion of one person, what does he or she really know? In this case, since this individual within our company works on that country and perhaps one or two more exclusively, we hope and we expect and we know that they are familiar enough with the country, in fact, in depth familiar with the country, to be able to make a qualitative judgment. So we gather the data from international sources where we can, and we use our own team of internal analysts to score the qualitative measures. Now, the results, we have a very nice map here. You have a copy of this in the delegate pack that you were given when you came into the room. This is just a traditional heat map. It's fairly obvious. You can see that which countries are doing best. All of these countries are scored on a numerical scale. As Clyde mentioned earlier, and we'll go over this in a bit of detail, but Western European countries, Canada, Australasian countries tend to do best. As a region, the Middle East and North Africa tends to fare worse. And you can get a good snapshot, a good data visualization snapshot of where the countries fare. Some of the conclusions. Again, we've previewed these a bit, but by and large, during the time that we've done this index, now over 5 years, and especially last year, we can say that the state of global peace has gotten a bit worse, especially between 2010 and 2011. Now, why is that? We've offered some reasons there, but perhaps the biggest reason that things got worse last year is interesting. It has a lot to do with the Arab Spring that we've seen over the last few months. As Clyde mentioned, when we put this index together, we typically do it in January and February, and we stop counting on December 31st of the prior year. It makes sense. We measure a full year. We then spend a few months to calculate the data. But obviously, there was a lot going on in the world in January and February. We did not want to miss this. So we held open our research period to March 15th. Still, we haven't captured, for example, everything, say, that's happened in Syria in the last few weeks. But we did capture the great majority of what was happening in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya. So because there is a civil war in Libya, because there were violent demonstrations in Egypt, because we've seen some rather unpleasant developments in Bahrain and other countries, all of this, understandably, has marked against the peace scores for these countries. Now, one could argue, and this is just a theory, but you could wonder whether there is something of a J-curve effect here. So in other words, you get worse, and then arguably, if democratic institutions are put in place in these countries that have experienced changes in the last few months, a year or two down the road, one would hope that you would see an upturn on the other side. Hasn't been proven. Hopefully, with support from the Institute for Economics and Peace, we'll do this a few more years, and we'll be able to report back on whether we get that upturn in it. So, in one way, things have gotten worse since last year. But you may argue that this is laying the seeds for a foundation where things might get better later on. We'll see. This is a list. Clyde has taken you through this. I'm just going to mention it very briefly. A couple of characteristics, though, about these countries. By and large, most of the countries at the top are either small or have relatively small populations. So Canada is not a small country, but Canada does not have an overly large population. Iceland, New Zealand, fairly small countries. So generally, one could potentially argue that these countries not having very large populations, being somewhat smaller, possibly somewhat easier to govern, fewer political tensions within the countries. They are also all, by the way, democracies, and I'll mention in a moment, there is an increasingly good correlation between democracies and countries that fare well in the index. The countries at the bottom are not a big surprise. As Clyde pointed out, Iraq has at least moved from the very bottom, has moved up a bit. Most of these countries, I think you know, with a few exceptions, have unique problems. There are civil wars in some of these countries. There are high levels of either political instability or internal violence within these countries. Somalia, Afghanistan, obviously, Iraq, some of these countries obviously in a state of war right now. These are the countries that had the greatest improvements last year. Again, you have all this information in your pack, but Georgia had been involved essentially in a conflict with Russia that ended about 2 years ago, so there was essentially a bounce-back effect after the Georgia-Russia conflict. Obviously, some improvements in Chad and its relations with Sudan, fewer homicides in Mongolia. Sri Lanka, as most of you know, had a civil war going on with the Tamil Tigers for many decades. That has ended. And some improvements in the levels of violence, political violence within Thailand. These are the countries that dropped. And again, with a couple of exceptions, most of these do reflect the developments we've seen in North Africa and the Middle East. So Libya is in a civil war, no surprise there. They dropped 83 positions, as Clyde had mentioned. Bahrain has obviously had some rather troubling developments within that country. We know about Egypt. North Korea, I think we can agree, is a special case. North Korea seems to be in the midst of a transition of government as the former leader perhaps is on his way out. And the level of repression there, from what we can tell, and it's difficult to tell, seems to be even worse than it was before. Madagascar has threw out their president 2 years ago and has been in a state of political conflict for the last couple of years. So again, some big drops here at the top, but I think unlike in the past when sometimes people aren't quite sure why we moved countries up or down, I think it's fairly clear why the countries at the top did move down. And again, the expectation would be a few years from now, if things work the way we would hope, that we would begin to see a substantial improvement when the democratic institutions are in place. I mentioned earlier that once we've completed the calculation, we try to look at the determinants or the drivers. What characteristics are there that are present in the countries that finish near the top that seem to put them in the position to have fairly strong levels of peace? Fairly high correlation with democracy. The Economist Intelligence Unit produces a democracy index, but some other organizations do. Good institutions, as Mark mentioned earlier, if you have a well-functioning government, if you have good levels of governance, there's a good correlation between that and peace. International openness, if you're part of a trade agreement, that seems to help, because if you're part of a trade agreement, arguably you're trading with your neighbors, not shooting them. So that's usually a good development. Education also seems to be reasonably well correlated too. So fairly good developments. We showed a few numbers here at the bottom. I think most of you know the way correlation coefficients work. Basically, the closer to one, the tighter the correlation. So you can see there that, interestingly, in doing many, many indices across many areas, whether it's for global peace, whether they're financial indices, whether they're indices on gender opportunity, it's amazing that corruption is a strong negative for almost anything. Corruption will turn out to be highly correlated with almost anything bad. Countries that disadvantage women, countries with poor environmental records, countries with poor health records, you name it. If a country is doing badly in almost any public policy area, they will have very poor corruption scores. And in fact, you can see this here. For those of you who are economists, this looks very nice, doesn't it? This is basically a correlation between the peace index and corruption, which is pretty much what you would expect. Just to jump back again, showing some of the other relationships, perhaps not surprisingly, there's a fairly decent relationship between countries that are better off economically, so higher levels of income per head with global peace. We mentioned good governance, functioning of government as well, and regional integration. The idea here now is that having looked at these over 5 years, and Clyde made a good point, you do this 1 or 2 years, you're never really quite sure what you're looking at. Now that we've seen similar patterns emerge 5 years running, we're beginning to have some confidence that there are relationships here that hold over time. And most of these relationships have held over time. So the idea at looking at these drivers is to communicate to the countries, especially those countries that are further down on the list, that these are areas for policy reform where if you do make improvements, potentially it moves you up the list. This is just showing quickly some correlations with income per head. Again, you see a nice movement from lower left to top right, showing that generally speaking, and not a big surprise, countries that are better off economically and have higher incomes tend to be more peaceful. So just to conclude, and then we can certainly turn it over to Barbara and open it up for discussion. Generally, small, politically stable countries, democratic countries, do very well in the index. 14 of the 20 countries are in Europe. 5 of the 10 are Nordic nations, Scandinavian nations. Island countries, with the exception of Madagascar, tend to do fairly well. Again, we were happy to notice that there seems to be a growing correlation between the level of democracy within the countries and the level of global peace. So with that, I'm going to conclude. Certainly, if any of you have detailed questions about how we did the calculations, there is a lot of quantitative methodology behind this. We'll certainly hold that to the Q&A sessions. But thanks very much for your time.
Barbara, Leo, thank you. Barbara.
Okay. Thanks very much. I'm going to stay put because I don't have any fancy PowerPoint. PowerPoints for you. I was a little worried that there would be overlap in our presentations, but I actually don't think there's that much. A little bit. This is the first time I've really looked at the Global Peace Index. As was mentioned, my primary qualification is that I've spent a fair amount of time in the bottom 20. I've never visited Scandinavia, so I guess that's my chief qualification to talk about it. But there were a few things that that popped out at me. I think what's interesting is not so much the top and the bottom, but the individual analyses of countries. And one thing that struck me was that it's possible to be a member of a major military alliance and still be very peaceful. It was mentioned that a number of these countries are in the top or European. 6 of the top 10 countries on the GPI this year are NATO members, which I thought was interesting, including Iceland, Denmark, Czech Republic, Canada, Norway, and Slovenia. A second thing that popped out at me when I looked at the overall rankings, particularly in the middle, is that China outranks the United States as a more peaceful state, albeit only by 2 places, and it's a marginal 2.054 versus 2.063. But still, that struck me when you think, of course, that China is not certainly as democratic as the United States. It was explained to me that one of the major reasons for this was the high, very high incarceration rate in the U.S., and this is astounding because you think of China as the police state, but the United States has 743 people in jail for every 100,000 population, and the figure in China is 120 Chinese per 100,000 population. I thought that was astonishing, since we like to think of ourselves as so superior to China in terms of human rights and freedom, but we've got an extraordinary number of people in jail. Obviously, another factor that keeps the U.S. low is the participation currently in 3 wars. The Chinese have figured out how not to become militarily involved in this way, whereas the U.S. has not. But one thing that I think the report should take into account, and it doesn't when it evaluates the United States, is that we have large historic responsibilities for maintaining peace on the planet and have had, certainly since World War II. One can argue that certain U.S. administrations have gone about fulfilling this responsibility in a rather feckless way, but the fact is that other countries and peoples continue to come to Washington to plead for U.S. military intervention on their behalf. We have the recent example, certainly, of Libyan rebels, and you don't see them going to Beijing and asking for China to intervene. They want the United States and they want NATO to come in on their side. So I think it's important to point out that a lot of the countries that are ranking very high on this index are essentially getting a free ride when it comes to safeguarding international security. The third point I wanted to mention, but in a slightly different way, is the status of Iraq, which has the lowest ranking in the Middle East and is second from the bottom, just above Somalia. It may be that Iraq has actually improved its scores, but 8 years after the toppling of Saddam Hussein, Iraq still gets a really wretched rating because of its continued high level of civil strife and the very high rate of displacement of its peoples. A couple million are still outside the borders of Iraq. And also the high level of military expenditure by the Iraqi government. It's 4.5% of GDP, which is about the same rate as the United States. And I think that's obviously exceedingly high. I would imagine that Iraq is going to stay at the bottom of this list for quite a long time to come. And if you stay at the bottom, of course, that presents certain challenges. Iraq wants a lot of investment, particularly in its oil sector. And if it's perceived as still not very peaceful, that's going to discourage a lot of potential investors. I was trying to speculate. Obviously, this index started in 2007, so one can't know where Iraq would have placed before. But I bet it would have been substantially higher under Saddam Hussein. Which shows us that sometimes the remedy is worse than the disease, at least in the case of Iraq and its peacefulness as a nation. Another factoid that jumped out at me that fortunately has not been mentioned by the previous speakers regards North Korea. You mentioned that North Korea is now less peaceful, but I noticed that North Korea spends a greater percentage of its GDP, 20%, on the military than any other country surveyed. I mean, that's nearly five times the amount of percentage in the U.S. and in Iraq. And North Korea, as some of you may know, has once again come to the international community begging for food aid, saying that its beleaguered people are starving. And if Pyongyang would devote perhaps a little less of its meager GDP to taking care of its own people instead of buying weapons and its dealing with its armed forces, perhaps we wouldn't see these kinds of situations. And it's, I don't know that the name and shame quality of the report will have anything to do with North Korean calculations, but I think that foreign governments that are approached for food aid should perhaps bring this up with North Korea. I think there's an American delegation in North Korea right now assessing the food situation there, and they might suggest politely that North Korea spend a little bit more money on feeding its own people. Finally, I thought it was interesting, and I had a conversation with Clyde on Monday about how these findings are being used. And I hope they will be used by journalists. I think it's another way to write about countries when we go there to look at their score on the GPI. I thought it was interesting in terms of the news in this country. There was a front page story just yesterday in major American newspapers about a Supreme Court ruling that could lead to the release of 40,000 prisoners from jails in California because these facilities are so overcrowded that conditions there are, quote, incompatible with the concept of human dignity, unquote. Another way in which I thought the findings were relevant, we're getting a new defense secretary, Leon Panetta, will be going to the Pentagon at the end of this end of next month. And I would imagine that he will be looking at the percentage of the U.S. GDP that's spent on the military, and perhaps this could help justify some more cuts in the Pentagon budget, especially at a time of fiscal austerity in the United States. In terms of academia, it was already mentioned that the GPI is going to be used now to formulate curricula at a lot of business schools around the world, and there, for the first time, will be a chair in peace and economics that will be funded. I thought it was also interesting the strong correlation between high levels of education and low levels of corruption, and that this should be a lesson particularly for developing nations. And Clyde told me that Malaysia actually referenced the GPI, sought to improve its ranking. It's now in the top 20, in part because it's worked to change the business environment in that country, make it more friendly to business investment. So these were some of the things that popped out at me. Perhaps as you read through the materials, look through the materials, other things will come out to you. I think I'll just conclude by saying that Clyde mentioned, or perhaps it was Leah who mentioned the way in which the media covers events in a number of countries. Of course, as you know, we have a saying, certainly in television, but I'm afraid also for print journalism, that if it bleeds, it leads. So let's see if we can find a way perhaps to come up with a catchy phrase for looking at more peaceful indicators and see if we can change some of the media coverage of the way we look at the world. And I think I'll stop there.
Barbara, thank you, and thank you to the panelists. Before we go to questions, I want to do two things. One, I want to point out a possible correlation that you might have overlooked. The fact that I two of the countries in the top 10, I worked for the former president of Finland, Martti Ahtisaari, and the person who's now the current president of Slovenia, Danilo Turk, and I just wonder if there's a Mark Quarterman correlation that might be looked at. And I also have a former colleague, Ambassador Taksøe Jensen of Denmark, too, and maybe future president possibly, but in the audience as well. And I want to congratulate Peter on where Denmark has landed on the list. And we also have Ambassador Hannesson of Iceland here. Came at the top of the list, and I believe that the ambassador might have a few things to teach us about peacefulness, and might have a comment or two to make along those lines. Ambassador.
Well, I don't. As I came in, I was asked whether I would like to say a few words, and being a diplomat, I of course said yes. Well, I'm a former teacher, but in this context, I really think this is very interesting. I worked for a long time at the United Nations, and the top 20, whether you are number 1 or number 20, in this case, I don't think it's all that much difference. The importance of this type of ranking, in my opinion, is for the bottom half to see, as you said about Malaysia, what are some of the things that correlate, and what makes people feel better about themselves and the society they're in, and how to better the whole world through that. Now, Iceland is one of 21 or 2 countries in the world without a standing military, and that is very interesting. Of course, we are a member of NATO, and we do pay our dues, and we have nurses and doctors and air flight controllers and so forth that are working with the Nordic military and with the UN and so forth, in Afghanistan also, with the international force there. So we do our due in peacekeeping around the world. Now, we are 320,000 people in Iceland. So anything in statistics, you can say one Icelander equals, well, statistically speaking, 1,000 U.S. citizens. And all the statistics you can play with like that. And I think that's, it's playing around with those numbers. It doesn't say much, really. We have very low crime. And other things that are correlating to peacefulness. We had a horrible economic downturn a crash in October of 2008. There were demonstrations in the streets. Eggs were thrown at the parliamentarians. Nobody was hurt, but these were very frustrating times for the population of Iceland. Slowly but surely it dawned on people that we still have trust in the legal system, and the several, let's say 20 mini Madoffs who operated our banks in Iceland, whom we were very fond of when everything went so well for a number of years. we were enjoying a boom. But our legal system is working. Some of these people absolutely broke the law, and they are being prosecuted. Frustratingly, it takes a long time, but the population is seeing and believing in the legal system. I think that's very important. I have one sort of question. Beside this first point I wanted to make, I mean, being number one in this is great. But, I mean, it's not very significant being there or number 20. The important thing is for the others to see that there are things you can do. But in Iceland and many of the countries that are in, let's say, top 10, family values are very strong, and social control through those type of values, and also the much less mobility of folks in smaller countries. I mean geographic distance even. That's what I'm talking about. The families stay together. I mean, people go abroad to study and come back. And the distance between the family members in the smaller countries is obviously much less. So you're interacting with your family members. Social control in a positive way that way. In the U.S., people graduate from high school or university, and they fly from the East Coast to West Coast and have a job there for the rest of their lives. So how much of a correlation is this close family value type of closeness with each other an important part in this peace index? Those are things I just... thought of as I was sitting here listening, and having also said yes to the young lady who asked me to say something. Thank you.
Ambassador, thank you very much. And before we turn to the panel to answer your question, Ambassador, I also would like to turn to Ambassador Taksøe Jensen from Denmark to make a comment and instruct us also on peacefulness.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for the presentation and also the report. I think it's extremely interesting, and of course I'm happy to represent a country on the top. I think the Icelandic are too modest. We should congratulate Iceland to be on the top of the list, and to ensure that is not going to happen next year, I propose that you put in a new indicator, volcano activity, so that we have a chance. I can also say that I'm not going to run for president, first of all, because I'm no politician, secondly, because we are a kingdom and we have a queen, so I'm not going to be a president in Denmark. One thing I would like to have had in this material, and I wonder if you have these overviews as well, is you have made this 5 years in a row now, and it would be useful to see how countries are moving up and down the list. You're only focusing on the top 10 and the bottom 10, but this sort of idea of how a country is moving would be very useful also for countries like my own, which are working with failing states, to see is there any improvement over the years. So I would just note that would be a useful piece of statistics to have as well, to see it over time. And then I noted that Barbara said she never went to Scandinavia. I think she should, because I have to say, when and set the record straight, that when you say, and I think you said, that those in the top are getting a free ride when it comes to global security, I'm sorry, that's not the case for all the top 10 countries. I don't speak for Canada or Norway, but I can speak for my country. We've been in Afghanistan since 2001. We have taken the most casualties per capita. We have the largest contingent per capita. We are in Libya now. We are carrying out 15% of the airstrikes there. So taking a free ride, I don't think is the right way to say it. Thank you.
Just point of clarification, I didn't say those in the top 10. I said a lot of countries in the world perhaps are getting a free ride, but I don't believe I said those in the top 10. So I know very well what Denmark and a number of other countries are doing in Afghanistan, Libya, et cetera. So I will double check.
Ambassadors, thank you very much. Maybe we'll turn to the panelists for responses and then take another cluster of questions after.
Well, perhaps I should, firstly, I'd like to thank the ambassadors for attending. Indeed, we've met before in New York a couple of years ago when Iceland, in fact, topped the list. I made the point during the discussion, but I've made it many times in the last 12 months that it shows the resilience of, indeed, Iceland or other countries. To Denmark's credit, I don't think it's been out of the top five ever, which is another commendation to its role. I agree very much, in fact, that whether you're at the top 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, or 10, or for that matter 20, doesn't really matter. I wear two hats here. Firstly, to me personally, it is more important if you're in the top 10% of countries, or in the bottom 10%, or indeed the middle. So I think that's where we learn. We learn the characteristics of countries that are at the bottom or at the top, or indeed, as I pointed out during my presentation, the movers and the shakers, the ones that are improving. And they're the real lessons that are to be learnt in terms of groups of countries with, as Mark said, consistent characteristics. So that is probably what is most important. The other hat I wear, I should say, is that I was one of the key people at the beginning who said, let's make it a ranking. Why? Because it works. It works in terms of countries wanting to get to the top. It works in terms of the media being interested. It works because customers comes from my commercial background. People, consumers, wanting to be interested. And of all of the groups of interested parties that the Institute for Economics and Peace has, the two that we never write in our documents but are frankly as important are indeed the media and people. That's, we want it to be people thinking, well, maybe I should actually try a little bit to get better on with my neighbour who's across the fence, and then I can worry about whether my country will get along with its neighbours. So that's very important. But the volcano indicator, I'll have a good think about that one. It would seem a little bit impartial if I would actually put it in for 2012, but we'll see how that goes. More importantly, and perhaps more seriously, the five-year rolling average is a very good point. Last year, we did, in fact, introduce four-year averages. We did, for the first year ever, trends, four-year trends, because we felt four was about as close to five as you could get, five being a more statistically valid period. And we decided, in fact, not to repeat that this year because we'd done it last year. But I think your idea of literally a graph that has the countries going like that, maybe on a regional basis, might be a good way to do it, like Africa and Eastern Europe and Latin America would be, it's an excellent idea, and I think we'll probably do it. So we'll put a little TM next to that idea for Denmark, being trademark. That's all the comments I have. Leo, do you have anything to add?
Not too much. I think Clyde covered it very well. I think probably we're going to have to go thumbs down on the volcano indicator unless we can find other forms of natural disasters and floods and other things so we can balance it out a bit. But the ambassador asked a question, interesting one, about family values and whether that could possibly be included. And it's an interesting question. Whether it's directly related to peacefulness, well, you could argue that if education is a driver, if democracy is a driver, then potentially interfamilial relations, to put a complicated name on it, could be important. So I think that's worth looking at. Probably quite a subjective measure. We'd have to see exactly how we could do that in a way that was rigorous. But we're always looking at the number of indicators and trying to refine them, and I think that's a very interesting suggestion. So we'll give that some consideration when we do the 2012 index. Thank you.
If I may add one more point, because Leo's just reminded me of something, that this year, as I said in my presentation, we did overlay the GPI with social sustainability values, and the International Institute for Social Studies is one of the institutions that actually spends a lot of time and effort, in fact, identifying whether it's specifically family values, I couldn't really say, but that intergroup cohesion was, in fact, one of the points that GPI is now correlated with from this year on.
If I could just briefly a little bit more.
I think
there we go. Yeah, in terms of a free ride, just to say a little bit more about that, I didn't say the top 10. I said a number of countries, and I was really thinking primarily of China, which ranks above the U.S. in terms of peacefulness, but is not is taking advantage of the economic opportunities, for example, that are provided by Afghanistan, its mineral riches and so on, but is not involved in actually fighting there or in many other places. One other point I thought was interesting. There are two very large democracies, or important democracies, in the bottom 20, and just my own question as to why they're there. One is Turkey and one is India. So perhaps you might address why they're in the bottom. And also in terms of the U.S. and its lack of peacefulness, I would assume that access to weapons or possession of weapons by Americans has a lot to do with the fact that it's not a very peaceful society. So I just throw those two things out there.
And we'll bundle those together with a few more questions, the gentleman in the third row.
Good morning. My name is Frank Vogel. I am with the Partnership for Transparency Fund and the co-founder of Transparency International. So first of all, I congratulate the ambassador from Denmark, because Denmark comes top of our list. So you may not be top of this list, but Denmark is number one on the CPI. Two, just a comment, if I may. We at Transparency International have constantly been asked to provide multi-year comparators tables, because we started in 1995 with a ranking. The problem is that the methodology from one year to the next and the content of the underlying indicators is not always exactly the same. And the number of countries we've ranked has not, in fact, has grown over the years. So all I would say is, a lot of people are obviously interested in how their country has done over several years, but there's a cautionary flag in terms of accuracy and methodology when you really get into making multi-year comparisons. My question really is really to all of you. You highlighted here the very close correlation between the results and perceptions of corruption. But there seems a disconnect amongst people who study peace and security in this area, where there's almost no discussion of corruption. It's either taken for granted, oh, that country's corrupt, but there is not really an analysis of what is happening on the ground to improve anti-corruption work or other things within the intelligence, strategic, and peace communities. Maybe this index helps, but I'd very much like to know your reaction. It seems to me that the major work on corruption is being done by people involved in economic development, not by people involved in security and peace and international affairs. And I wonder how you react to that, because clearly this is a tool to help.
We'll take one more question in this cluster. The gentleman in the second row on the side here.
Thank you. David Birnbaum from the Wilson Center. Two questions. First, did you examine the relationship between peace and income distribution within countries? And if so, where did that lead? And second, I think this issue about interfamily relations is a subset of a broader factor that you did consider, namely culture. And when you look at these rankings, it leaps off the chart that five of the top 10 are Nordic, and one of the top 10, indeed three, is Japan. Surely culture has, I would think, a very significant influence on those outcomes. How did you look at culture?
Traditionally, just in terms of question and answers, what we have done, for those that haven't been here before, is we get the most qualified person to answer, and so that's what we'll continue to do. So what I might do is address, I think I'll leave Leo to deal with the income distribution and the Gini coefficient. I think he'd be well qualified to speak on that. The question of corruption is a very interesting one, because if there is an area where business has a role to play in engaging in this peace debate, and I've been looking for it for a few years, and I sit on eight boards of publicly listed companies, that is probably it. In other words, if I was to be blunt, I think it's fair that you could say that business sort of steps away from conveniently in-depth discussion about peace and operating in countries where there is a lack of peace and, you know, all the mineral resources questions, etc. And it's indeed be Steve Killelay, who's the chairman of the IEP, and my sort of personal and professional agenda to try and engage not just with NGOs and politicians and diplomats and academics and other philanthropists, but in fact to get peace involved. And indeed, it's a long answer to a short question, but Steve is at the International Chamber of Commerce meeting two weeks' time in Mexico has been invited to do a plenary session on business and peace. We've got the president of Nestle and various others. So that point of corruption, I understand very well, because in fact, business is directly involved in. Certainly in Australia, if I'm even aware that any of the countries which companies that I deal with internationally are being corrupt in their countries, I can be prosecuted. It gets quite tricky, particularly sitting on so many boards. So my point is, I think that's the little overlap of the Venn diagram is where business, corruption, and indeed the peace and strategic fraternity might actually find some fertile ground. That said, clearly it's not 100% clear in my mind, but I think that's actually a very, very good point and one where I think we'll probably be going over the next year or two. Secondly, I'll just make a point on the culture. It took us quite some time to define peace. I don't even think I would want to try and define culture. I'm sure there are people who are much, much more qualified to do so. So I don't know is the answer. I think we haven't really looked at it in terms of Nordic culture or, what's that, East Asian culture and how that overlaps with peace. So I think it's one that we'll make a note of and actually think of over the next 12 months and then discuss with the expert panel, probably more so the EIU, because the EIU will if we can think we can find a way to measure it, then they're prepared to put in the effort and the analytics to do it. But we'll have to sort of put that one aside for now. And perhaps, do you want to have a discussion about Jeannie?
Yes, I'll just address the culture issue briefly. Clyde is right. It's going to be a question of defining what you mean by that. Now, I can tell you that if you recall, we have these external drivers that we try to match up against the results of the index. And one of the things we do look at least, is political culture. And we define political culture by the democracy index that we produce. So at one level, now see, you didn't quite ask this question, but I'm inferring that what you were really asking is how homogeneous are the populations? Does it matter if you have one population that is essentially of one racial, ethnic, or a group in that fashion? You didn't ask that, but I think that's perhaps what you were getting at. From a political culture standpoint, there is a correlation. Democracy is an element of political culture, and there is a good correlation between democracy and this index. We looked at some other things that I didn't mention. There wasn't a terribly good correlation, but we looked at the correlation between a degree of religious cohesion within a country as well, too. Interestingly, did not find a particularly strong correlation between the degree of sort of religious fervor in a country and the index as well, too. So what I would say is on culture, let's define it very carefully. Clyde's right, we have not looked at it in that broad a term, but we should define it. But elements of culture, like political structure, religion, education, I would submit to you that all of those things constitute culture overall, and we have looked at a lot of those. So I would encourage you, take a look at the report and look at how we measured those elements of culture against the index, and it might have some interesting results. Just on the Gini coefficient, the Gini coefficient is a way of measuring the level of inequality or lack thereof within a society. We haven't measured this against a Gini index, and that's a good point, Clyde. We should probably do that. I suspect, though, from what I know about that, is that we would find that there's probably a reasonably good correlation. I mean, Canada has, for example, a less unequal society than the United States. Canada is near the top of the index. The U.S. is quite a bit further down. I know that most of the Scandinavian countries have relatively good income equality, or let's say less inequality than some other countries as well. So I can't answer it directly, but my guess is there would probably be a decent relationship between the index and income inequality. I'll stop there.
There are a couple of points you raised.
Well, India has any number of difficulties. India, of course, has a lot of terrorist incidents take place in India. India's relations with Pakistan, of course, are awful. India's had quite a few wars with Pakistan. There are a lot of troops on the border pretty much all the time. India also has fairly high levels of communal violence within the country between Hindus and Muslims. If you think about that, actually, India is obviously a wonderful success story economically in terms of software production, outsourcing, and so on. But politically, there are quite a few issues. Plus, if you actually look at those little bits of India that are kind of up there off to the right that nobody ever looks at, there are various insurrections going on in India and quite a few people trying to secede from the country. So India has a number of issues. And Turkey also has issues with Kurds in Turkey as well, which tends to push them down on the index. We have reasons for just about everything.
Barbara also raised the point about guns in the United States.
One of the indicators does look at access to small arms, what we sometimes call weapons of minor destruction as opposed to major destruction. But yes, the fact that that small arms are very available in the United States. One could argue that that is a controversial indicator to include, but nonetheless, I think it is appropriate. And yes, the presence of large numbers of small handguns in the United States does weigh on the U.S., pushing the U.S. down into the 80s. Absolutely.
There was a woman in the second row who raised her hand earlier. Yes.
I had a question about. Hi, my name is Carol. I'm from Midlothian, Virginia. I have a question about the effect of the drug war in the United States. If just the impact if drugs were legalized or monitored a little better, we'd have less of the corruption that's going on in the streets, possibly.
And we can bundle that together with the gentleman in the plaid shirt here in the second row.
Hi, I'm Greg Sanders, CSIS. One question on indicators, one on correlation. Have you looked at doing any external peace positive indicators, humanitarian aid, successful mediations, accepting refugees, contributing to UN peacekeeping forces? And on the correlations, trade agreements had a correlation, but there was none for imports and exports as a percentage of GDP. Do you think that's just being confounded by small countries tending to have a very high percentage? Or do you think that's an interesting distinction? Thank you.
And one more question, the gentleman in the second row here. His hand up.
Yes. Is there a spreadsheet available with the data on your website?
Okay. I'll address those.
The drug wars in the U.S., in fact, drug wars more broadly, are included to the extent that they result in violence and that violence is measured. So, yes, is the answer. Do we require that the EIU make specific analysis and evaluation of that? Then that's also in. So likelihood of violence, the actual deaths from internal conflict, all of those things are covered as in measured. It is quite extraordinary that in Mexico last year, when you think that in terms of external conflicts, the GPI takes into account any battle that involves more than greater than 25 battle deaths, that in Mexico last year there were 12,000 deaths related to drug-related violence and 30,000 in Mexico in the last 5 years. So certainly I think we can safely say that the GPI does take that into account, broadly speaking. On the positive peace indicators, we specifically avoid it. That's not to say it's not a moral or ethical judgment on whether or not positive peace is relevant. Obviously, it's something that we would work towards. But when we set up the GPI, we wanted something that was very clearly definable and measurable. And that came down to the absence of violence, or absence of violence, three words. That's what we aim to measure. Why? Because we could, and then we had to find somebody who could actually do that, which was the EIU, and then we had to get an overseen independent panel of experts to tell us that we're on the right track. So, but we, you might say, philosophically, we strongly, with the IEP, philosophically strongly believe in the positive peace institutions, and in fact that's really where our rationale for starting to look at social sustainability issues, which actually are almost a proxy for many positive peace measures and certainly considerations. So it is important to we do try and address it, and indeed through the 33, I think it is, other variables that we look at as potential drivers of peace, I would say that positive peace aspects are in there to a fair extent, or as much as we possibly can. Trade indicators, if the imports and exports are of heavy weapons, then it's in. If they're not, then we don't measure it. I mean, we measure it, but we don't allow for it. It was actually mentioned to me by the ambassador from Norway 5 years ago at the UN, in fact, in New York City, who I was sitting with after Norway sort of, you might say, took number one position in the first of the GPI, and he was saying to me, you know, we've done very well, and there's Denmark and, you know, Iceland and Sweden. They seem to be down a bit. And I said, imports and exports of heavy weapons. And he went, ah. So, you know, it does have an impact. In fact, Sweden is the only Nordic state not in the top 10. They still do pretty well, I might add. I think they're 13th, but nonetheless. On the spreadsheet, beg your pardon, no, not all of the data is available. You can look at the countries, do comparisons, look at every indicator, where we sourced it from, etc., but we don't actually have a spreadsheet. The spreadsheet is, you might say, proprietary. It is actually available, but not on freely distributed, or freely it is. It is free as in no pay, but it's not widely distributed, let's put it that way.
Just to follow up on one or two of Clyde's points, we do have one indicator that's in the model right now that does look at the level of contributions to UN peacekeeping operations. So there is one element in there that one could argue does have an element of positive peace in it. On the other point about trade, exports and imports as a share of GDP is one of those 33 determinants that we use to measure against the overall index. The correlation, I don't have it in front of me right now, it wasn't terribly high. But again, part of the reason for that, and I think you inferred this, is that countries that tend to be very, very open tend to be small trading countries. Singapore's exports and imports as a share of GDP is about 350%, and Hong Kong is about the same as well. So it tends to be more a function of your economic system, the size of your country, whether you're an entrepot. U.S., for example, doesn't actually have exports and imports as a share of GDP being all that high, but that's because the U.S. has a very large domestic economy. The U.S. produces a lot of what it consumes itself. So it's a good point. It's a good question to ask, but really the industrial structure of the country and where the country is located, the size of the country, can be more important towards exports and imports than some other factors. Yeah. It is. In fact, Clyde just points out to me that the correlation is really only about 0.1, so it's not much of a correlation. But again, it's because there are other factors pertaining more to the industrial structure of the country, the size and where it's located. We try, by the way, to proxy for that by looking at level of regional integration. If you think about it, level of regional integration tries to get at the same thing you're asking about, which is exports and imports as a share of GDP.
There's a woman in the fourth row, I think, who had her hand up. Here.
Thank you.
And there.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Mary Leopold from Peace by Peace, which is the international women's organization that raises the voices of women to build cultures of peace. And so out of feminine solidarity, I hate to go back to the free ride, Barbara, but I have to. It seems to me that the question assumes that military intervention or military whatever is a good thing. And I, speaking, I guess, for myself and not for my organization, it seems to me that Iraq, which you went to right afterwards, where we've spent trillions to make a bad situation worse, sort of demonstrates the opposite. And I see a huge difference between Iceland sending doctors and nurses to NATO and weapons in general. And I don't understand, I guess I'm so naive, why we can't just feed the people in North Korea instead of waiting for their leaders to be chastened by their bad ratings. So this is me thinking like a woman.
And there was a question over here. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Alfred Farrugia. I'm from an island that is not represented on the index yet, from Malta. My question is very similar to the one just made, actually. I was struck by the remark made by Ms. Slevin that in the case of Iraq, the remedy was not perhaps as good And this is what I wanted to ask. Is the GPI telling us something about the remedies, for instance, in the case of Libya, as well as in Iraq? Thank you.
And we'll take one more question, a gentleman who is very patient in the second row who had his hand up.
Aaron Voldman with the Student Peace Alliance. Can you weigh in on the correlation between internal peace and external peace?
Yeah, I guess I wasn't putting a value judgment on how the United States responds to these kinds of crises. I always remember Madeleine Albright berating Colin Powell for his reluctance to use U.S. military force in Bosnia. What is this military of ours good for, this wonderful military of ours good for, if not for situations like this? You know, it's the way the United States has been pretty much since World War II. U.S. came out as a military victor. Most of the rest of the world had been vanquished and got into the habit of military intervention. Korean War, Vietnam, Central America, through its own forces or through proxies, through weapons, and changing that culture in the United States is obviously going to be a long-term project. We have terrible difficulties getting funding for the State Department and for all the things that it does for USAID. There's a figure out there, I think, that the foreign affairs budget is something equivalent to what the Pentagon spends on military bands. I heard that one once. Pentagon budget is huge. Organizations like yours, you know, need to work on that, and we need to obviously devote more resources to economic aid, to diplomacy, than we do to military force. But that's a real long-term project, and I wasn't, you know, saying that I approve of it. I'm just saying that that's the way it is. Oh, on Libya, yeah. The United States was actually a reluctant entrant into that war. As I recall, Britain and France, particularly France, were much more aggressive in terms of advocating a military solution to the problems of Libya, and the U.S. came along and provided resources. So perhaps that question should be directed to President Sarkozy or Prime Minister Cameron.
Just a couple of comments on remedies. Certainly in the first year or two, I think the GPI wasn't seeking to, other than the extent to which it acts as a tool for others, provide remedies. But I think now certainly the work of the Institute for Economics and Peace to broaden out the GPI, and indeed that is the eight structures that I referred to earlier, which is in the documentation, well-functioning government, solid business environment, these sorts of factors, low levels of corruption, high levels of education. It is characteristic of all of the countries at the top of the Global Peace Index, let's talk in quartiles or deciles rather than ones and twos, that they have these structures in place or indeed can move along specific almost policy lines now if they want to be improving their situation. So does the IEP or indeed the GPI say what can be done next week or next month? No, that's sort of outside our charter. But does it now provide statistically solid and related information that governments can actually use and start to make medium to long-term decisions on? I think the answer to that is yes, and that's in the discussion paper of this year. Internal and external peace, I'm not quite sure exactly what you wanted to understand further. The GPI is split into an internal and external evaluation. I wouldn't say index because then we'd have three and that gets confusing. So let's call it an internal-external ranking so that the indicators are split, the 23, into internal and external, and they are then combined. That is not public. Why? Because it's just part of the ingredient of the cake. What is true is that a lot of the factors related to other social development issues that are strongly correlated tend to be more strongly correlated with the internal, let's call it, ranking or index for the purposes of this, rather than the external. And It's also worth pointing out that the internal measures account for 60% of a country's score, and the external peacefulness measures account for 40%. And why is that? Well, that was beyond the EIU and beyond the IEP. That was, in fact, the International Panel of Experts who really innovatively 5 years ago said, peace begins at home, I suppose, just like that old thing, charity begins at home. You could say peace begins at home, and if we could get a more peaceful state within our nation, wouldn't that account for more than and make us more likely to be peaceful externally, which we all collectively sort of bought into. So that's how our internal and external is structured. Is that answering your question?
I guess I'm curious about how well, or when a country performs well internally in its peacefulness, the degree to which that's correlated with how well it's
We do actually, have an answer to that. If you in the book here, the correlation between internal and external peace is 0.28, which is to say not all that high. So it is interesting. I mean, you can be internally peaceful. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be externally peaceful. Claude, I can return a favor. You helped me before, and it's here on the list as well, too. So, and as Claude mentioned, though, we generally find that when we look at those outside determinants, they tend to correlate better with measures of internal peace than external peace as well. But the correlation between the two, it's a good question. It's not quite as high. You can be internally peaceful. It doesn't automatically mean you're going to be externally peaceful. Also, one other thing to bear in mind, from our standpoint as the mechanics putting this together, this is measuring relative states of peace, peacefulness. We in particular, and the Institute for Economics and Peace has taken this to a further level, but if there are activities that are not peaceful, you will be marked down in the index. Now, one could make a judgment. Should there have been intervention in Bosnia? Should there have been intervention in Rwanda? There are cases where one could argue. You could argue, I'm not arguing this, that perhaps it was necessary to go into Libya, whether you believe that or not. If you do it, if a country participates, you will be marked down in the index because we are simply looking at the measures of peacefulness. It's not to say that there may not, in extraordinary cases, be a good reason for doing that, but it's simply looking at the relative measure of peace. It's not my role, especially, to make a judgment on whether these are correct or incorrect actions. It's simply if you're at war, then you're not at peace. Whether you should be at war is another question.
Except that you're giving credit for participation in UN peacekeeping.
Yes, we are. In fact, I'll address that because that was very much an indicator sourced by, in fact, calculated by the IEP, not EIU. That also I would probably put in the realms of innovative thinking of the International Panel of Experts along with the Institute and in that case, to a lesser extent, the EIU. That was rigorously debated for months in 2006 leading up to the May 2007 launch. And I would have to say that many on the panel, and indeed their advisors, vigorously argued that how could we have any measure that rewards or positively associates violence, military, with a peace indicator. And we said, well, because we're not making a judgment as to whether or not they should or shouldn't be there or it's right or particularly wrong, what we are prepared to say, and this is where the Institute draws its line, is that in, let's call it utopia, there is no violence here. We don't need police and ideally we don't need a military. But if there were a military presence that actually resolved, or was able to resolve both conceptually and in practice, major disputes in the world, then that would probably be a good thing, rather than us all going our own way or indeed forming blocks for that matter. So we came up with the notion that we are prepared to reward. In fact, in the first 2 years, the measure was not funding of UN peacekeeping missions. It was the number of peacekeeping troops that were provided. That was the measure in the first 2 years. Now, if I can tell you why we changed it, if you like, but We changed it, in fact, because there was a lot of countries that actually send troops, but they're funded by other nations. And Japan funds a lot of peacekeeping missions, but for reasons of its constitution, cannot and will not send troops. Other countries, a lot of African nations, will send troops, but they can't actually necessarily afford it. So we found that funding peacekeeping initiatives for the UN was the fairest way. So, and indeed, I'd have to say that's why we get very, very little criticism, probably from the military. any military, because we haven't taken an anti-military stance. We're just saying if it was done in that way, we'll give it a green light. If I can go one step further, we then discussed NATO in the first year, 5 years ago. Should NATO missions be voted, you know, positively? Well, that is a particularly Western way to look at it, particularly NATO way to look at it. And we did make the ruling, the judgment, that we actually couldn't discriminate positively towards one particular military bloc versus another. So we said none. It's either UN peacekeeping forces, to which we will positively rate it, and so you can go to the top of the index, or certainly up it, by doing that, or it's none, or not at all.
I'd like to thank our panelists very much. They have been terrific. One thing I suppose they say in show business is always leave them wanting more. This has been a lively conversation. A number of people would like to jump in, but our time is running short. I know we applauded after each presentation, but I think they deserve a general round of applause, too, for an excellent presentation. And thank you all very much for coming.